It's embarrassing to sit silent. Hence my pause, just to make you feel it for a second. But for 7 whole days and 7 whole nights, to sit in one another's company and nobody utters a word. Yet in that time, how many thoughts must have been raging through the minds of the 4 of them? And as the 3 friends look at Job, perhaps as Job looks up at him, though he may be too involved with how he feels to notice, there is a silence. At this stage, it is an empathy. As I suggested to you before, they were friends. And they were equals, if they indeed were all dukes of Edom. They were equally important in their own cities and friends together. As I suggested last time, the breakup of this friendship is the work of Satan, that in a moment or two he is about to seek to accomplish. And we must be on our guard that strife does not separate between very friends, that different opinions don't separate between very friends, that those who love the Lord equally should not be separated by an understanding or misunderstanding of the experience of those who've been friends. Those who are friendly, those who are friends should show themselves friendly. And this the friends attempted to do. Job later calls them miserable comforters. But he never says they were miserable friends. He merely says that their attempts in their friendship fell far short of what he had hoped for from them. Of course, they were silent because they were observing Job, and it was only appropriate that it would be Job who would break the silence. And when Job did break the silence, he opened his mouth and cursed his day. Now, of course, you cannot speak without opening your mouth, but here the suggestion is that he cried out with a loud voice, that the words that he said about the day were wrung out of him in anguish and anger, that he was so full of the bitterness of his spirit and the pain of his body, racked as it was, that he burst out words that are quite irrational when you examine them, though the words themselves seem quite fine. And again, we need to bear in mind in dealing with one another and in understanding ourselves that in times of great pressure, in times of great pain, we may say the things that are irrational, that a moment's sober reflection or a moment's healthy reflection would make us understand that no, we were overwrought and we said things that would have been better left unsaid or were of no edifying influence to ourselves or to others. And so Job says, let the day perish wherein I was born. Now that sounds already good, but as I say, it's irrational. How can you rescind a day that has gone? You see? It's not logical, is it? And so, this is something that is pure emotion, pure affliction, pure pain. This chapter of what Job says is not for our doctrine. We are not to look at this and see here and say, well, this is the way to cope with these things. This is a faithful recording, inspired recording of how he felt and how he responded. But this is not to be taken, bearing in mind that the Lord speaks of his words without knowledge when God does speak to him directly. So these are words without knowledge. These are words that we do well to note that could happen to anyone under great affliction, and that we are not to be critical for them. For the Lord himself does not take umbrage at these words. The Lord himself always regards that he is his perfect servant who will not renege on his faith and who will not curse God and who will not give way to Satan, despite Satan exercising the maximum power that he has permitted against him. We must bear in mind all through this that through the ups and through the downs of all this, Job is perfectly acceptable to the Lord. He deserves criticism from the Lord, gently, afterwards. Who is this that speaketh words without knowledge? Is this my servant Job? But it's nothing more than that. He never suggests that Job is blaspheming. He never suggests that Job is giving up his faith. And when we hear people say things that really we think Christians are not advised to say, that Christians say under pressure and under ill health perhaps, or sickening for something, and at the time we don't know this sickening. You remember that the Lord does not condemn man for a word, does not make a man an offender for a word, as Isaiah 29 has it. So when he says, let the day perish wherein I was born, you see, the healthy ones think, well, he's being ungrateful to God. Is not life wonderful? And has he not received many benefits in his life? And now he wishes that he hadn't been born? Let the day perish wherein I was born. He's cursing his day, but he does not curse God. And indeed, he does not curse his friends. Let the day perish in which I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. Well, of course, that, as you can see, is after the event. The night of conception isn't always known anyway. But even if it were, it wouldn't be known that it was a man-child. So you can see that this is a reflection afterwards. But he's cursing the fact that he was ever conceived, cursing the fact that he was ever born. And the things that he heaps upon these things just illustrate how deep this matter goes, understandably, in his heart, seeing that he is covered with boils from foot to toe. Foot to head. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Now, it is clear that what he's saying is either that he wishes the day should be expunged from the calendar, or else that he should never be reminded of his birthday, because it does look in Job 1-4 that when each of his sons, each on their day, feasted with their brothers and sisters, that it was birthday. Probably that is the significance of it, that it was the way they celebrated birthday. And Job is saying, well, I never want to hear about it. Never want to hear about mine again. I never want any such thing to come into remembrance at all. It's stained with the shadow of death. It's stained with thick darkness. I don't know if you've ever had the feeling where something bad has happened, if someone you loved died in a road accident in a particular place, or something that you really went deep with you hurt you, happened in a certain place, if you felt in your heart that you couldn't bear to go by that place again, or think of that place anymore, you may know the feeling, but if you do, you will identify a little bit with something of what Job is saying here. He feels, and the feeling is revolting, it brings revulsion into him, the whole thought of that day and all that that day brought to pass. And as for the night, he says, the night in which I was conceived, obviously 9 months apart, not the same night as the day. But if you go back to that night, he says, oh, it's terrible. Let there never be another night like it. Let that night be solitary. Let it be dismissed from the calendar. Let there never be a joyful voice in that night again. If you've ever had the feeling, I remember once coming away from hospital with somebody who just lost a loved one. And the world carries on as if nothing had happened. And there's that great contrast between the bereavement that you've known and the world couldn't care less, carries on as it always does and as it must do. But if you've ever felt that, you'll understand a little bit about what Job means when he says, let no joyful voice come therein. Let those who are ready to raise up their mourning, let them curse that night. The raising up of mourning, well, it reminds you, does it not, of the passage of the Lord Jesus Christ when he's put out those who've been the professional mourners who've been brought in. He put them out of their house and they laughed him to scorn when he said that the girl was not dead but sleeping. They knew otherwise, as they thought. But they were professional mourners. They raised mourning in that sense. And so those who raise mourning, whether they get others to help them do it, whether they get professional in, but he said, let those that are ready to raise mourning curse. Curse in the words that they sing, in the way that they beat their breasts. Let them curse that day. Let the stars of the twilight be dark. Let it look for the night and have none, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, because it was a successful pregnancy. But here's the main point, the thing that it's really all about, because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hid sorrow from mine eyes. It's the sorrow that he's now undergoing that is the dominant thing. Nothing to do with the past. Nothing to do with the past. All to do with the sorrow he's now enduring. It is this that prompts all these thoughts, all these thoughts that are so bad, all these thoughts that are so unhelpful, thoughts that are so unedifying, thoughts that won't build up his faith, thoughts that tend to the destroying of the faith and the causing of anger in the hearts of his friends. But sorrow has come to him now. He's engaging in sorrow upon sorrow for who knows how long, and he maybe thinks that he's going to die. These are the reasons that he says these terrible things, and yet they're irrational. And neither does God take offence at them. Well, under pressure, who knows what any of us might think or might say. We should labour, of course, not to give offence or not to be unedifying or not to destroy the faith of others through our words brought out of us under times of great pressure. At the same time, our friends should not dismiss us from their thoughts or think that we put ourselves beyond God's pale, or are not worthy of our prayers, or any further connection. And then he asked the question, why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? It is one thing to long for life to end because as a believer you're in great pain. And indeed that is one of the ways that the Lord uses to loosen our ties from this world. That we're brought to the pass where we can no longer enjoy the pleasures that once engaged our attention, or the work that once took up our energies, we're brought to the point where there is nothing here that we can further enjoy. So a believer turns his heart towards glory. Now, that's not the same for an unbeliever. But if that happens to a believer, that's a good thing. And he may not want to live any longer. But what Job is here saying is not that he doesn't want to live any longer. That he's saying that he wished he'd never lived at all. That's quite a different matter. If you'd never lived at all, of course he couldn't be saved. You can't be saved if you don't live. And so again, he's talking an irrationality. He's talking a nonsense, which doubtless he knows to be nonsense, or will later be convicted that it was nonsense. But at the same time, it is understandable. It is born of this great thing that's happened to him. He knows not why. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? The word prevent means to anticipate, and here it means to catch. And it is said that in Roman and Greek cultures, and in the old Hebrew culture too, the men would take the newly born on their knees, and that would signify their ownership of the child. Equally, it might refer to the midwife, who catches the baby falling from the womb in her own knees. But that's why did the knees prevent me? Why was I caught? Why wasn't I allowed to fall? Why did I not fall on the floor and was dropped and broke my head? Why did I not die in the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I was born? Why was I caught? Why did the breasts give me nourishment? If I had died, I should now have lain still and been quiet. Now, he's going to go on and say, same as the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes say, that one event comes to all. That is, that we die. And it is true that physical death does make us all the same, that we're lifeless. Now, not all people are equal at the time of their death. Some may be kings, some may be poor. Not all people die in an equally pleasant or painful way. And the only thing that is equal about death is its lifelessness physically. Now, when he goes on to say that the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest, in verse 17, in death there is peace, these things are not true to the unbeliever. Who knows whether the wicked cease from troubling others in hell? Maybe this is a characteristic of hell, that those who are bound for hell still carry on troubling one another in hell. We don't know whether it is so or whether it isn't. The weary unbeliever will not find more rest in death, because there's pain, eternal torment. So these words are to be seen as a sort of anesthetic. Seems nice when you're very, very ill to say, oh, if I were to die, I'd be at peace. But you see, it's dangerous if that person's an unbeliever, because there is no peace, says my God, to the wicked. It's dangerous to take this view of death, that dying will be a great release. It may be a release, but at the same time it may be an introduction to something far worse. So the things he says here which sound very nice about death, for now should I have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept, then I have been at rest with kings and counsellors of the earth. If he is indeed the Jobab mentioned in Genesis and 1 Chronicles, then he was indeed a king. And his predecessor was a king. And his successor was a king. And his friends were kings. They were the dukes of Edom. Well, he would have been at rest. But of course he would have been an untimely birth. Or stillborn. Both of which are mentioned in verse 16. And death renders whether you've lived outside of the womb or only within the womb, it renders all men dust to dust. But there's nothing else in common. But he makes this case, as it were. He makes it sound all very attractive, just to be asleep, just to drift off, just to have no more pain. And in that sense, they're dangerous. The prisoners hear no more the voice of the oppressor. It sounds lovely. And then in verse 20, wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul? Now I expect that you have been with elderly believers who wonder why their life is prolonged, who long to leave this earthly scene, who long to go to be with the Lord. And they say in their heart, why doesn't the Lord just let me go? Why can't I just drift away? I'm doing no good here. I'm a burden to people. Why doesn't the Lord just take me? Job says, verse 20, wherefore is light given to him that is in misery? Why then am I allowed to live? Why is life given to the bitter in soul? Now we know the answer to that question. We know that the answer to that question lies in the Lord and Satan. The Lord is proving that Satan is utterly wrong in his understanding of mankind in general, in reading into such a one as Job his own terrible thoughts of cursing God. And God knows that that is not true of Job and is not true of believers in Christ. And so he puts this whole matter to the test. And the answer, though Job doesn't know it, is that you're being kept in life to win the battle on this particular point against Satan. He may not feel he was doing anything. He never was weaker. He never was less able to accomplish anything. But this is why he's in that state, and he is going to win. But he can't make out what use he's being. And that just reminds us that if the Lord is prolonging our life, in the purpose of the Lord, it has profit. Nothing happens in the purpose of God that has no meaning. And whether it be that we are allowed to live so that others may learn to pray, whether it may be that we are allowed to live so that others may prepare for a similar situation to occur in their life later on and see and make a note of how that they would manage it. Whether it is that there are those who will die, who will respond to the faith at our death and be moved by the fact that now we've gone, that all these years they didn't take advantage of our witness and our things we might have helped them with. Whatever the reason, we may be sure there is one. And so the question that Job asks here, it's a rhetorical question at the time, but we know the answer. And we must take courage that we know why light is given sometimes to those who are weary, those who are ill, those who are dying. Why life is prolonged. The Lord has a purpose of salvation. The Lord has Satan to defeat over a particular issue. We know not. We may know in glory, we may not. But we may be assured that there is reason for it. And then, in verse 24, he speaks about his roarings. David, in Psalm 32, spoke about the roarings. He roared day or night when he bottled up his sin and didn't confess them to the Lord. And by that roaring, he doesn't only mean the loud expression of his sighs and his woes, but he also means the troubling of his conscience. Now, that may not be the case here, no conscience, but certainly the description of his upset and his pain as a crying out is a roaring. And these last two verses, "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came." The question we must ask is not only what is that thing that was greatly feared, but first of all, when? When did he greatly fear? We do not know the answer, but it's a good question for us. I have sometimes said from the pulpit that, do you remember, I've said to you that there was a day when I was young and I saw this terrible road crash with people lying in the road and it was pouring with rain. And as an 11-year-old, I just ran past the scene. But the one thing I always felt that I didn't want was to die in a road crash, in the rain, in full view, public view of everybody, covered by glass, blood, surrounded by others. Just the whole thing seemed too horrible. Now again, we're talking about very deep things, and I've invited you to consider, is there any parallel in your experience in some of these things, so that we might understand Job. He speaks of the thing that is greatly feared. Some greatly fear accident, some greatly fear tragedy, some greatly fear cancer or some other thing. And therefore, if you know this experience, the thing which is greatly feared is come upon me, again we ask ourselves the question, why did the Lord bring that which he most feared upon him? Why would he do that to us? Not often, just once, in the thing we greatly fear. Now, what was the thing that he greatly feared? Now, verse 26, he says, "I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came." He's saying that it wasn't all peace and quiet, as if the Lord needed to sort of stir me up out of a dream world of quietness. There were dangers from the civilians. There was always dangers from these other people I didn't have rest particularly. There was a lot to do, a big estate to administer. There were things that didn't always go right. I wasn't always quiet. There were things that disturbed me, things that didn't add up in the finances, things that didn't work out with the camels and things. I had all these things. It wasn't that I needed stirring up, but trouble came. Was the thing that he greatly feared the loss of his property and his status? Now, I don't think it was. And for this reason, that when Job did not curse God when he lost his property and his sons, Satan said, but there is one thing. Now, Satan does not have supernatural knowledge. And that one thing that he felt would be the weakness of Job, he expressed as skin for skin, everything that a man has will he give for his life. It was his general twisted observation that threatened somebody's life and they will curse God. So maybe if there is one thing that he greatly feared, it might have been being struck down in the prime of his life. But when would he greatly fear that? The impression that I get is not that he'd been a man who'd had a great fear all his life long, but that this was the next step that he sort of felt with Satan's sinister moving around him. That once his property and once his children had been destroyed, what next? And there could only be the death of his wife, or a terrible illness leading to his own death. And they, I think, were the worst fears that he felt might be realised. The thing which I greatly feared is come upon me. Maybe he means, by verse 26, I was not really ready for death. I was not prepared for death. I was in the middle of all my activities and hadn't prepared for death, nor a lingering death, nor a being deprived of my glory through my illness. Well, we don't know exactly. But when the thing that we greatly fear comes upon us, then we are to draw closer to the Lord. This is his intention. Whatever other his purposes may be, his purpose is that the thing which we greatly fear, there is no fear in love. And the one who fears, says John, is not made perfect in love. And you can understand how the Lord might want to take us through our greatest fears, that we might trust him perfectly. When trouble comes, may have nothing to do with our outward situation. I was carrying on as normal. Some things were difficult, some things were hard. I wasn't in safety, nor was I at rest, neither was I quiet. Satan says I was hedged around, and he doesn't know that, of course, but of course he knows he was surrounded by the Lord. But he was heir to all the sort of things that were going on. And yet, trouble came. He was fulfilling his role, yet trouble came. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. And we do well to be prepared in our heart that trouble may come, and to strengthen our hearts that when trouble does come, should it be of the Lord's provision, our heart will be strengthened and strong and firm, and cling ever closer to the Lord for his love and support in that time of trouble. Job is distraught. Job is desolate in his own feelings, but he is not abandoned by God. Amen.